Today is Tuesday, June 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. An expert says you can't reform the police without reforming society.
I think there is a fundamental racism in American society, and police officers are recruited from within American society.
Plus, North Korea destroys an inter-Korean liaison office, increasing tensions.
South Korean media reported a loud explosion and smoke near the border.
And the WHO says the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening. We'll have those stories and more next. In a sign of just how fast protests over police violence and racial prejudices are transforming national politics, U.S. Senate Republicans are close to rolling out a big package of reforms. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
It's a sudden shift in priorities for Mitch McConnell's Senate.
A serious proposal to reform law enforcement.
With even the most conservative senators on board with restricting chokeholds and other police practices. But the package does not go as far as a broad Democratic proposal. And after weeks of unrest, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's warning the GOP the public will demand more.
Not change around the margins.
It's unclear whether the two parties will find common ground, but Democrats suggest they are willing to look at GOP ideas, some of which are mirrored in an executive order President Trump will sign today. Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump did sign that executive order on some police reforms, which a senior administration official said aims to invest more and incentivize best practices. A senior administration official on Monday said the order will create certification bodies to train officers on de-escalation techniques and use of force standards. Another part of the order will push for creating a so-called co-respondent service, in which officers pair with social workers when responding to nonviolent calls, especially those involving mental health concerns and drug addiction issues. Proposals for police reform come after weeks of nationwide protests over the death in police custody of George Floyd, an African-American man. He died last month in Minneapolis, Minnesota, after an officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Protesters are continuing to demand an end to police violence and equal treatment before the law. Their grievances are supported by a majority of Americans and have already inspired many cities and state governments to rethink how police do their jobs and ways that racism and the legacy of slavery continue to play out in America. However, some police experts say that the police are not to blame for society's racism. Now, to learn more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with author Maki Haberfeld, a police science professor at New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice and a former police officer.
I think there is a fundamental racism in American society, and police officers are recruited from within American society. So addressing just policing is not going to change anything. Policing is an arm of a government. If anybody should change, it has to start with the government.
What about ethnic and racial diversity within police departments, such as the New York City Police Department, where you teach?
First of all, NYPD is the most diverse force on earth. I would say anywhere between 80 to 85% of my students represent African Americans or Hispanic or Asians. So they don't feel that they are racist, but they operate within a context of an organization that is subject to various deployment tactics that are imposed on them by politicians, and in this case, by the mayor. The mayor hires and fires police chiefs. These are the local politicians who tell the chiefs how to deploy and what kind of tactics are acceptable and can be used. So the police is not going to change based on different type of training. The police is only going to change if the government will require this change of standards for recruitment, the change of standards for selection. And this is not something that an individual police department can change. It has to come from the state and municipal government.
Police have a reputation for operating within a fairly closed and self-protected world.
people say, well, it doesn't matter, once they join the police, they're all blue. And that's not the case. It's like any other profession. You do have certain characteristics that are common for everybody. But to say that everybody on police force is racist is to say that everybody in any other profession is racist. And to blame police for this is absolutely ridiculous. People are in denial and they refuse to acknowledge that racism is embedded in everybody.
One major criticism from demonstrators and community activists at the moment is the so-called militarization of the police, with tanks, military-grade weapons, SWAT teams, and the like. How do you respond?
The militarization of the police is because of the availability of guns in the United States, and therefore police departments increasingly try to be a step ahead. Somebody can purchase AK-47, then of course that the local police departments will want to have AK-47. But we should not be using military-grade equipment against civil dissent. It might be there for cases of major terrorist attacks, for mass shooting situations, but it should be given to police organizations with explicit prohibition against anything other than an active shooter situation. And the problem is lack of oversight. But you cannot have a proper oversight having 18,000 different agencies. It just doesn't work.
Where do you think the prospects are going forward? Do you think that the historic opportunity offered by this moment will be fulfilled or squandered?
I fear that it will be lost in the sense of actual change, because everybody is talking about training, everybody is talking about community policing. Nobody is talking about changing the centralized nature of American policing, consolidation of police departments. Right now we have over 18,000 autonomous police departments. But when we are going to consolidate, we are going to be able to create different standards for recruitment, for selection, and then go into training. So I am afraid that we are going to lose this very important moment.
Maki Haberfeld is a police science professor at New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and she was speaking to VOA's own Adam Phillips. Now, the French government says it will allow chokeholds until a better immobilization tactic emerges, despite promising to abandon it. Nicolas Pinault has those details.
French Interior Minister Christophe Castaner delivered the news to union officials during a meeting to clarify his position after days of protest among French policemen. The cops claim a chokehold is the only safe technique to arrest uncooperative suspects without using their guns. Chokeholds are still legal for current members, but the controversial technique would no longer be taught to police officers and prison staff. The announcement stopped short of total ban, which was the original plan when the minister promised, and I quote, zero tolerance against racism by the police. Speaking to union officials on Monday, the minister said that there had been a misunderstanding amongst the police over the ruling. In a further attempt to quell discontent from police officers, who have been under growing scrutiny over high-profile deaths in the U.S. and Europe of suspects while in custody, France said it was widening the testing of tasers, which had led to a number of deaths in Europe. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News in Paris.
And still to come in today's program.
You say that U.S.-China relations have, you say, three dimensions, a strategic dimension, the economic dimension, and an atmospheric tone of the relationship dimension.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to legend, the Fountain of Youth is supposed to be a magical spring that brings back youth and vitality to those who drink or bathe in its waters. Medical science continues its quest for some kind of miraculous elixir that could stop and reverse the aging process in people. A recent study by researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, suggests science just might be close to providing a medical version of the Fountain of Youth. The researchers, working with mice, replaced half of the blood plasma in old mice with a mixture of saline and albumin, the chief protein in blood. They found that this treatment rejuvenated tissues and reversed signs of aging in the old mice. The Berkeley team says it's now completing clinical trials to find out if a modified version of this therapy might, in the future, be able to improve the health of old people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On Monday, the World Health Organization warned that the coronavirus pandemic is worsening globally. Reuters' Gloria So has more.
More than 136,000 cases were reported worldwide on Sunday, the most in a single day so far. That announcement comes just as countries like New Zealand, which no longer has any active coronavirus cases, further relax their stay-at-home restrictions. Technical lead Maria Van Kerkhove urged countries not to let their guard down too quickly.
So let's celebrate the successes that we do have, but let's remain focused on the remaining work that needs to be done, because unfortunately this is far from over.
The WHO noted that the pandemic has not yet hit its peak in places like Central America, where infections are still on the rise. Brazil is now one of the hot spots of the pandemic, with the second highest number of infections, only behind the United States.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. Over 8 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 have been recorded on a Johns Hopkins University tracker, and over 437,000 deaths have been attributed to the novel coronavirus. In Asia, North Korea has confirmed it destroyed an inter-Korean liaison office on Tuesday as it continues to dial up pressure against South Korea amid stalled nuclear negotiations with the Trump administration. VOA's Bill Gallo has more from Seoul.
Shortly before 3 p.m. local time Tuesday, South Korean media reported a loud explosion and smoke near the border. A few minutes later, South Korea confirmed the de facto embassy had been blown up. North Korean state media later said the four-level glass and steel building was destroyed with what it called a terrific explosion. The move was primarily symbolic. South Korean staff left the liaison office in late January due to coronavirus concerns. Over the past week, North Korean officials had repeatedly threatened to destroy the facility, which was set up in 2018. North Korea is ostensibly angry at South Korea for not doing more to stop defectors and other activists from floating anti-Pyongyang leaflets and other materials across the border. North Korea has a long history of periodically ramping up tensions in order to extract economic and other concessions from the South. Currently, Pyongyang is frustrated that Seoul has been unwilling to push ahead with improving inter-Korean ties. By threatening South Korea, the North also appears to be using Seoul to pressure Washington over stalled nuclear negotiations. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
India says at least three of its soldiers, including a senior army officer, have been killed in a confrontation with Chinese soldiers along their disputed frontier high in the Himalayas. Thousands of troops on both sides have been facing off there for over a month. The Indian Army said that a violent face-off took place in Galwan Valley in the Ladakh region on Monday night, with casualties on both sides. China accused Indian forces along the border of carrying out provocative attacks on its troops, leading to serious physical conflicts between the two sides. A German court will begin hearing the case against two far-right extremists accused of killing a regional politician. The execution-style slaying of Walter Lübcke shocked the country last year. Lübcke, a member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's party, supported her decision to allow hundreds of thousands of refugees into the country in 2015. Stefan Ernst, a 46-year-old with previous convictions for violent anti-migrant crimes, will appear in the Frankfurt Regional Court accused of murder, attempted murder, serious bodily harm, and firearm offenses. The second man, identified only as Marcus H. due to privacy rules, is charged with accessory to murder and breaking firearm laws. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam on Tuesday urged opponents of Beijing's plan to impose national security legislation in the financial hub to stop smearing the effort, saying those who did so were the enemy of the people. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam urged opponents on Tuesday to stop smearing the effort. Beijing announced the proposed legislation in Hong Kong last month that tackles secession, subversion, terrorism, and foreign interference, and could see Chinese security agencies set up in the city.
I urge opponents who still use the usual tactics to demonize and smear the legislation work to stop, because by doing this, they're making themselves the enemy of the Hong Kong people.
Lam's Beijing-backed city administration says the law will bring stability and will target a small number of troublemakers. But critics see it as the most serious threat to the one country, two systems formula, aimed at ensuring Hong Kong's freedoms and protecting its role as a financial center. Restrictions on social distancing, which currently only permit gatherings of 8 people, are due to expire on Thursday. The government will relax the rules, but they will not be completely scrapped. The restrictions have helped limit numbers at demonstrations, with police citing the coronavirus and rejecting applications for rallies. But many locals continue to risk arrest and are joining protests.
Remember this day, remember why we started the whole revolution, whole movement. And it's really important for people to remember how sad it is to lose even just one of us.
More than a year since anti-government protests first erupted in the city, hundreds of people gathered again last night, patiently queuing for hours in a line that wrapped around the block to lay flowers at the spot where a protester fell to his death last year. The national security law is expected to be enacted before September.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo plans to meet a Chinese delegation at a U.S. military base in Hawaii this week to discuss bilateral ties. The world's top two economies have been at odds over trade, the coronavirus pandemic, and China's new security legislation in Hong Kong. Roy Denny is a senior fellow and U.S.-China relations expert at the East-West Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. He was speaking to International Edition's Lori London about the significance of the meeting.
Reportedly, he's meeting with Yang Jiechi, who's a former foreign minister and now has moved on to an even higher ranking position. So the Chinese are treating it as a pretty serious meeting. You could say that U.S.-China relations have, you could say, three dimensions, a strategic dimension, an economic dimension, and an atmospheric tone of the relationship dimension. And all three of those dimensions are in a downturn at the moment.
So why now? Is this politically driven, given that this is an election year? Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, first of all, the relationship being in such a trough is reason enough for the two countries to understand that they still need each other. They still need a constructive relationship, and they need to get the relationship back on the track where they can at least cooperate on issues of common concern. But even that's in danger at this point because there's been such a deterioration this year. But when you say politically motivated, I think you mean domestic politics.
Correct.
Certainly, it's an advantage for both the Chinese government and the U.S. government in front of their respective domestic audiences to appear to be capable of managing this important relationship well. And it's especially valuable if both of them can argue to their domestic audiences that they got a win. So the real challenge here will be after the meeting, both sides to be able to go home and say, I got some progress from the other side on an issue that's important to us. But of course, it's difficult for one to win without the perception of the other losing. That's where the political gamesmanship comes into play.
What issues do you think will be highest on the agenda to try to resolve, and are they actually feasible?
There's some important political slash strategic issues that need discussing. Hong Kong is probably at the top of the list, but also North Korea. The United States and China have sort of gone their separate ways on North Korea over the last year or so. The Taiwan issue is, again, becoming more salient, as there's at least a perception that, based on a lot of media reports, that China is getting a step closer to seriously considering military action. But I think that the issue where there's the greatest likelihood of progress being made is the economic issue, particularly picking up the pieces of the phase one of the U.S.-China bilateral trade agreement.
Do you think that's something that can be accomplished?
I think that's a feasible goal because it's in the interest of both countries to get the situation back to at least an even keel, with both countries facing some economic difficulty as a result of the pandemic, especially to not have the additional problem of the upsetting of supplies and supply chains with such an important economic partner. It really becomes important in domestic politics of both countries. Also, it's an area where both sides can sort of claim a win.
It's interesting you mentioned the pandemic, of course, because we've been hearing the Trump administration blaming China quite a bit for this. I know that angered China quite a bit.
Generally, when there's a meeting like this, both sides will make their own opening statement, and I don't know that the rhetoric will get put aside. Both will have an opportunity to sort of vent, but then beyond that, once they state their basic grievances with the other side, that's when the real work begins. It's a matter then of crafting some areas where they can cooperate and agree, despite not everything being fixed at that atmospheric level, including the acrimony over the pandemic.
And what about the contentious Hong Kong law? Will Chinese officials even be willing to discuss that?
I expect that that will be one of the areas where both sides offer an opening position that seems to offer no room for accommodation by the other side. They're completely irreconcilable. But beyond that, with the Hong Kong issue, there's actually some room for moderation on both sides. That is, the Chinese could interpret and implement the new law on national security very strictly and very expansively in such a way that creates a lot of additional political problems. Or they could leave it at sort of a symbolic stage, at least for now, not press on the accelerator, get the law passed, very cautious about how they implement. And on the U.S. side, the options range from the United States completely disavowing any special relationship that Hong Kong has with the United States and treating it just like every other part of China for all purposes. But on the other hand, the United States has the option of standing pat with the tough speech that President Trump made that we might do certain things, but then actually implementing our retaliation for what the Chinese are doing in a very limited and targeted, even symbolic way.
We've been hearing a lot about how China has taken advantage of the unrest here in the United States over some of the racial injustice, police brutality issues. Would you agree with that, that China is capitalizing on that?
The answer is absolutely yes. The Chinese are taking advantage of the turmoil in the United States over the issue of racially motivated police brutality. I see it as a continuation of the place that the Chinese had got to in the rhetorical battles with the United States during the pandemic. The Chinese started out sort of in defensive mode, and then as they perceived they're being attacked by the United States government and other countries, and then they moved to a more offensive mode. And where they ended up at the end of May was frequently raising the idea that the United States, based on its pandemic response in the United States and its accusations of China as being the source of the disease and not handling it well and causing more problems for the rest of the world, which the Chinese are very unhappy about. The Chinese outward-reaching diplomacy latched onto the theme of the U.S. pandemic response proving that the United States is not fit to be a world leader. And the disturbances in the United States now and the attention given to police brutality has now given the Chinese a lot more fodder, which they have used to continue that argument, specifically that the United States talks a lot about human rights, criticizes human rights, particularly in China, but the United States is hypocritical in doing this because we now see that the United States is full of problems itself. Therefore, it ought to not only stop raising these issues with other countries, but shrink from its claims to international leadership on this or other issues.
Roy Denny is a senior fellow at the East-West Center in Hawaii, and he was speaking to International Edition's Lori London. U.S. President Donald Trump says he wants to reduce troops in Germany to 25,000, accusing Berlin of not paying enough to support the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, also known as NATO. Reuters' Carolyn Malone has those details.
Nearly 35,000 U.S. troops are usually stationed in Germany. There's been an American presence there since World War II, more recently to counter Russian aggression. Now Berlin has been told the Pentagon will reduce numbers to 25,000.
Germany, as you know, is very delinquent in their payments to NATO. And they're paying 1%, and they're supposed to be at 2%, and the 2% is very low. It should be much more than that. So they're delinquent of billions of dollars, and this is for years delinquent.
Many NATO members boosted military spending in 2019, but some, including Germany, have not yet reached an agreed target of 2% of GDP. Poland has. It held joint military drills with the U.S. over the weekend. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said earlier in the month he hopes reassigned troops will come to Poland.
I deeply hope that as a result of the many talks that we had and that we have shown what a solid partner we are within NATO, that part of the troops based today in Germany, which are being removed by the U.S., will indeed come to Poland and will strengthen the eastern flank of NATO.
NATO members are part of a North American and European alliance of defense from outside forces. Trump has criticized Germany's spending and accused it of taking advantage of the U.S. on trade. But some Republicans in Congress have argued the troop cut would be a gift to Russia.
Carolyn Malone reports for Reuters News. And Germany's foreign minister today said his government has been given no information about the troop movements. He also said that the U.S. forces in Germany are important for both European and U.S. security. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.